Anyone have any questions, particularly practice-oriented, meditation questions, anything like that? Yes, ma'am. Let's turn that on. I better turn mine on too. There we go.
What are the best ways to train introspective awareness?
The best ways to train introspective awareness. One way that you could look at the practice of meditation is it's all about training introspective awareness. Because the only way you can ever overcome distractions and dullness is to recognize them before they become a problem and correct for them. And of course, the only way that you can recognize them is to have introspective awareness. So in that regard, you could think of from the practices from the first through the sixth stages are really all about cultivating introspective awareness. I mean, granted, in the first and second stage, you're basically just learning to discern awareness from attention and learning to sustain peripheral awareness. And it starts out mostly extrospective. But by stage three, you're starting to be concerned with recognizing gross distraction before it causes you to forget, and that's introspective awareness. And there's the first technique, is the checking in with attention. If you check in introspectively with attention, that is going to have the effect of training introspective awareness. Because awareness does, whatever it is that you intentionally do with attention is becomes the behavior of awareness. So when you're using attention relatively frequently to check in and say, okay, am I distracted? Am I dull? What's going on in my mind? Am I clear on the object? Was I thinking about something? That is, you're using attention, but awareness picks up on that cue. You start to become more introspectively aware. And this is one of the first things that happens in the training of the mind that makes your mind operate differently than it has the rest of your life. Because, your thoughts and emotions have the ability to grab onto attention and let you know about themselves, right? And so we just don't cultivate introspective awareness. I mean, there are a lot of good reasons, being vigilant, protecting yourself, guarding against problems. There's scads of good reasons to develop some degree of extrospective awareness. But normally, life doesn't create a lot of pressures on most of us to develop introspective awareness. Well, it does in some cases. I mean, to the degree that you realize that you always make a fool of yourself in certain situations, you can become motivated to become more introspectively aware in those situations. So, but anyway, stage three, you start using attention to train introspective awareness. From that point on, you have this intention to recognize the various forms of distraction and dullness before they take you over. And so now you're exercising the awareness you have, which naturally makes it stronger, and the need to do any sort of checking in with attention diminishes. And you start to have more and more of the experience of being aware of thoughts and mental states and things like that. when they're still in the form of subtle distractions and when you can deal with them. In that process, of course, what's happening, your introspective awareness is getting stronger, but there are parts of your mind that are making use of this information. They're also getting the message that whenever there's sufficient conscious recognition of a distraction, there is a correcting activity that takes place. And likewise for dullness, especially with all the work that you do in stage five, constantly watching for subtle dullness and brightening up your perception. So it starts to become automatic as your peripheral awareness becomes stronger and stronger, and as it takes on more and more of an introspective character to keep watch for these things, it starts being responded to more automatically. It becomes almost like a reflex. And then you start to have the experience of, you know, the subtle distractions never become gross distractions, because before they start to, somehow you just automatically catch them and correct for them. Only the really strong ones, the kidnapper bandit ones, the ones that come on all of a sudden and they grab you right away. But the ones that are there, time to get caught, they don't keep you from. The next big development in introspective awareness, which is the important one, the most important one, ultimately, is that metacognitive introspective awareness, where your mind, and you first start to experience metacognitive introspective awareness when you start to notice that your mind's automatically correcting for distractions and dullness. Because that's that there, you know, it's that difference between knowing that something's happening and knowing that you know that something's happening, right? That's the metacognitive level. You know that you know. And as it becomes more and more automatic, there's less doing, and there's just the knowing. And so you start knowing that your attention is really stable on the meditation object. Or you start knowing that, well, it's fairly stable, but it's, you know, it's moving somewhat. Or maybe you know that it's today for some reason, maybe because you've got something on your mind, it's highly unstable. But you're in that place of you're knowing what's going on, and your knowing of what's going on doesn't require you to somehow step outside of what's going on or interrupt what's going on. It's just, it's really, you know, wherever you, the observer, is, you, the observer, is now somehow on a different plane and can see what's happening without having to be a part of it. And once again, that training is mostly happening through intention. But of course, by that time, you've got a skill level that allows for that. You know, a lot of the nitty gritty work that has to be done is happening automatically, and only occasionally does there need to be this intentional, purposeful action of correcting. So it requires a certain skill level to have that sort of very strong, continuous metacognitive introspective awareness. That's where you move into stage seven, and the thing that really allows your metacognitive introspective awareness to come totally to its full potential to be realized is when you don't have to be constantly in that place of vigilance for distractions and dullness, and to step in when it's necessary to make the correction. So that's the peak of it. From then on, you've got powerful metacognitive introspective awareness in meditation. Now, this is going to overflow into your daily life, but you want to worry. It's so valuable that you can't just wait for it to overflow. You want to start exercising it as much as you can and as soon as you can. And I suggest your best opportunities for doing that. A lot of your day is spent, it varies from person to person, but there's a significant part of everyone's day that is spent in activities that don't require a lot of involvement. And these are great opportunities to practice introspective awareness. So while you're driving a car, chopping vegetables, walking to the corner store, you know, there's a zillion other things like that. Now, most of the time what we do is we're gone. We're somewhere else. Your body is driving your car down the road, but your mind is somewhere else. Somewhere else. But if you come into the present, there's only, you know, and you stay in the present, what are you going to do with all this consciousness, you know? And that's why the natural tendency is to use it to do something else. But what you can do with it is that you can turn it inward and you can practice being introspectively aware. And of course, it's exactly the same as meditation. You start out and you say, okay, I'm going to be introspectively aware. Well, the only thing that's happening is I'm looking to see if anything's going on in my mind. I'm looking to see what's going on. So you know, it's kind of like in stage three. It's the same thing. So, okay, I'll pay attention to driving. And paying attention to driving is just like paying attention to the breath. But now I can practice being introspectively aware of what's going on in my mind while I do that. You can do the same thing while you're walking or cutting vegetables or zillions of other things. And those are all the kind of things that, I suppose it depends on where you're walking. If you're doing glacier walking, maybe it's not true what I was about to say. But most of those things, you know, they don't require you to be terribly involved in what you're doing. So that's a good opportunity to practice that, make it into a meditation. And hopefully that's what all of you are doing when you're not formally sitting and formally walking, is you're practicing meditation in the way of being very mindful. Mindful of what? Mindful of what you're doing, mindful of what's going on, especially mindful of what's going on in your own mind. Yeah. So, and it follows the whole same process that it does in meditation. As you start to get better at it, as you start to be more mindful, as you start to have more introspective awareness, it becomes easier to have. So you can start being introspectively aware while you're engaged in activities that require much more of your conscious capacity for the fulfillment of them. And, of course, it's at exactly that same point that you're ready to turn your introspective, try to become more metacognitively introspectively aware. So that's basically how you do it. By wanting to. Yes.
I was trying that practice a lot because I've been doing a lot of working in the kitchen as well as formal sitting. And I also felt like I had kind of compartmentalized, you know, this is sitting. So I just started asking myself the question, well, what's the difference, you know?
Yeah.
Why is it different walking to the meditation center than being in the meditation center? But it feels like I've created this difference in my mind. Mm-hmm. So I asked myself this question, And there were a few answers that were really interesting. Like, one was that there are certain things that require more mindfulness, that are harder to be mindful of, like talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the one difference. But then a lot of the other differences had to do with, like, maybe my own internal reactions, like the feeling of needing to be kind of on edge in a social situation or being alert, you know, or having to keep up a certain amount of, like being mindful feels like letting you not down your guard in that situation. And the other one was like kind of a feeling like, and this doesn't have anything to do with what we're doing here, but the feeling was like, oh, you have to be safe to be mindful. But then what came to my mind was the one time I was in a really dangerous situation, I fell on my bike in the street. And being mindful was very helpful, actually. Because I got up really quick because I was practicing mindfulness as I was riding, and I hit a slick and it was ice, not a puddle, and I went down. But I jumped, you know what I mean? The mindfulness actually helped in that situation.
That is a very astute set of observations and an analysis of it. And thank you. Yeah. You mentioned being safe. You have to be safe to be training yourself, and especially when you're being more introspectively aware, because. Yeah, if you feel unsafe, you're going to be very extrospectively aware, yeah. And for good reasons. And that is precisely the purpose that mental faculty serves. Yes.
I have a follow up to that question. That was really helpful, actually. Thank you, Nick and Shiladasa. So I made a mistake during my practice where I misunderstood, despite the fact that you really laid it out quite clearly in the book, I misunderstood what it meant to intend to have introspective awareness at stage four, where you're paying attention to mental objects, thoughts, and emotions. And the mistake that I made, and we talked about this, was almost understanding intention as like throwing a penny in the wishing well. Like, I would just say, okay, I intend, you know, I would sort of like try and like work up like a head of steam at the beginning of my sit and say, I intend to see thoughts and mental objects. But then when I was practicing, I was just paying attention to the breath and was sort of imagining that the mind would take care of the introspective awareness because of the intention I had set in quotes, air quotes, verbal air quotes. but that was not right. And we cleared it up, and I understood that there's a sort of action that along with in which that intention manifests, where you sort of, and you describe it in the book, you sort of, it's best conveyed through analogy, right? You almost sort of stand back a step and sort of look over the breath's shoulder a little bit. Mm-hmm. And there's this idea of, you sort of don't turn your head to look at the stuff, but you just see it out of the corner of your mental eye. And that, it was very evocative as an analogy and very helpful to me. And once I started taking that action, that sort of intentional action of saying, all right, I'm going to look at, you know, using my sort of peripheral vision, it came together. My question is, so as I approach the point where I'm going to need to focus more on developing metacognitive introspective awareness, which is around the bend, I don't want to do the same thing. I don't want to toss a wish in the well. I intend to be aware of the contents of my mind, especially since there are so many things that it involves. It involves like four different things that are sort of the state of your mind. It involves a couple different things that constitute the activities of your mind. And then it's all summed up as, I intend to be an objective observer of my mind. Is there a correlating action-y type thing in the same way that there was with the more basic introspective awareness, where it wasn't just setting your intention real hard, like sort of verbally or whatever? Is there a thing you do in the same way?
There are things you do, Yeah, but first of all, is that intention and continuously renewing that intention. But in terms of things you do, it's very similar. You're going to be using attention to tell awareness what it is you want to do. So what metacognitive awareness allows you to perceive that non-metacognitive introspective awareness doesn't is it's that larger scale view of what's happening. So introspectively you become aware of thoughts and emotions. But emotions really are mental states. And the ones that we label emotions and think of as emotions usually, they are particularly strong, well-developed mental states. There's a lot of there are mental states that are subtler. I mean, you can have a really strong emotion of impatience, but you can have a feeling of impatience long before it becomes that strong emotion. And so really it's having the intention to be aware of the subtler mental states. And there can be several of these going on at the same time. I mean, you can actually have mental states that seem to be in conflict with each other. But if neither is very strong, you could have a sense of satisfaction with your practice. But at the same time, you can have this sort of niggling impatience and stuff like that. So it's having the intention to be aware of these subtler mental states. Likewise, you are, when you check in with attention earlier on in the process, you discover that there was a thought going on. And you realize that actually you were giving that attention some thought before you ever checked in. You find, oh yeah, and I obviously been giving that thought some attention. So what you will get with the more metacognitive perspective is just seeing the behavior of attention over a period of time. Seeing its degree of instability and appreciating it. Not in terms of, you know, oh yes, there's that particular distraction, and I realize that I've been, you know, it's there. You experience the distraction as it stands out from the background. But this is at a different level. You're aware that there are movements of your attention taking place, or you're aware that the attention isn't moving very much. Or the same thing with subtle dullness. You're just aware that that the quality of your perception is altered, either to the good or otherwise. So it's the same way. You're going to be checking in with attention. Once you form the intention to be metacognitively aware, you can't help but have attention want to jump in and help. Right? As you've already experienced that before, and you know it's just always going to happen. And it's totally all right, because attention is going to jump in, and attention is at least, and this is the thing that, you know, I've got to emphasize, is that it won't work if you're not ready yet. You can't, you know, if you start trying to have this level of metacognitive introspective awareness and you're not ready yet, it's not going to work. And temporarily your mind may cook up a little fantasy about how you're being metacognitively aware. But it's not really. You have to have sufficient mental power to be able to do this. Because, well, don't need to get into details of it any more than that. But you're going to let attention take a look, identify these subtleties, and then your attention is going to let go of it, and you're going to continue to have this awareness of these subtleties for a while. And this is how you're training your mind what you want to have happen, and it'll just start happening more and more.
And it requires that, like you said before, it does require that automaticity of checking for both distractions and dullness that come at 4 and 5. Those are sort of prereqs.
Yeah. You have to get to the point where a lot of the basic work is being taken care of automatically.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Could you make an analogy to any kind of, so when you gain expertise in something, let's say you're learning to play tennis or something where you have to really be in the game. And so when you're first learning how to do it, maybe you're just learning how to hit the ball and you're just paying attention to where the ball is. Okay, I've got to hit it. When you do that enough, that then becomes an automatic thing that happens. And so you can start to notice, because you're watching your game or you're watching your mind, you can start to notice these higher order patterns and maybe the higher order interventions, because the lower, simpler things are just happening automatically. So
exactly. It is a perfect analogy. It's not a metaphor, it's an analogy. Exactly the same process of all kinds of motor skills. In the beginning, you know, I never got good at tennis, but what I remembered is be so focused on, you know, doing the return just right that the ball was already coming at me again and I wasn't ready. And it has to get to the point where it's automatic. And then you can sort of move to the next level. It's exactly the same. Playing music. I think even everybody's had the experience of driving a car. And at first, you know, it's like, how on earth do I keep going straight at the same time as controlling the speed? And, you know, if you learn to drive a standard transmission, I've got to do so many things at once. step on the gas, let off the gas, push in the clutch, let the clutch off, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then it becomes more and more automatic. So it the way your mind works, basically our mind evolved. It learned simple ways to do things, and then it just extrapolated those to higher and higher level. And so your mental, you train the mind in exactly the same way you train the body. After all, you're training the nervous system.
So, thanks, that was really great. So, you talked about being introspectively aware during daily activities. If we are not at the place where all our prereqs are lined up, you know, if we don't have those automaticities and we don't have all that conscious power, should we, even if we want to be introspectively aware during activities, should we sort of content ourselves at that stage with being introspectively aware of mental objects in the more stage 4, stage 5 sense, and not try to do something that, as you said, might not work? Or should you start poking at metacognitive introspective awareness off the cushion before it's time on the cushion?
You know, there's never anything wrong with trying something to see what you can do, but it's the circumstances. Like, when you're in heavy traffic trying to negotiate a switch from one freeway to another, you know, not a good time to practice introspective awareness. Right. So the timing is important, but there's never anything wrong with trying it. But you have to expect that if you're having trouble remembering to be mindful at all 80% of the time, then trying to exercise some metacognitive introspective awareness of what are the underlying motions behind the impulses that are arising, and, you know, what are the mood states that are triggered by the things that you're experiencing. Don't expect to have too much success, and don't be disappointed, you know, if you don't.
When it sounds like if you haven't had enough experience continuously watching your mind, you may have words to describe the kinds of metacognitive insights you could have, but they may not match up to your kind of intuition or your experience if you haven't actually watch long enough to be like, okay, oh, that's what that meant.
Mm-hmm. When
that's what settled emotion is.
And you will have that experience of, I get it. You know, you have it, and you'll know it, and
I would like to know, so is there a point where it naturally happens, or is it something that's even possible? I'm wondering if shamatha practice and metta practice, so loving kindness and then, you know, insight through mindfulness, you know, is there a point where they become the same or join somehow? Like, is that something that happens or that can happen or that one could try to do? Get them to kind of fuse?
It certainly can happen. Now, I've never tried to do this myself, but in the commentaries it describes how you can use each of the components of the divine abodes, you know, the Brahma-viharas. As a practice to actually achieve samatha and to achieve jhana. So there's what it describes is you know, for example, you can't go past second jhana using joy, you know, sympathetic joy for the successes and happiness of others. But of course, if you can get to second jhana with that, then you're ready to. You don't need an object of attention anymore, and you can let go of the joy and move beyond that. Mm-hmm. So, like I say, I've never tried it using loving kindness as a way to achieve that, but I see absolutely no reason why not, and it is described in the commentaries.
So I guess my question would be maybe something that you could speak more directly to, like just to start with, like how, like if I'm really into a metta practice,
mm-hmm.
how to also be practicing mindfulness. It's mm-hmm. as clearly as I'm trying to when I'm doing something more simple, like just observing the breath.
Yeah. Like I say, I haven't done it, so I couldn't tell you how to do it. But, you know, to the degree that you're really clear on what you're trying to do with samatha practice in general, then it's just a question of you're having a different mental activity taking place and a different focus of your attention. So if I were going to set out working on that practice in that way, that's what I would do. I would have the roadmap of where I'm trying to go. I'm trying to unify the mind. I'm trying to, what's the mind going to unify around? Well, it's going to unify around the feeling of the wish for loving kindness, feeling this in myself and holding this wish for others. So that's what my attention is going to be preoccupied with. And so I'm going to figure out, I would then go to figure out, okay, so how do I develop the mindfulness part of it? So this is what my attention is going to stabilize on. And you know, from doing loving kindness meditation, you don't have a lot of mind wandering when you're doing loving kindness meditation. It's a pretty powerful attention grabber. So you're not going to have to do a lot of work in that department. You have to do a lot more work on the mindfulness part of it, the awareness part of it, the introspective awareness, and the metacognitive introspective awareness. But I'm sure you could. And then if you do, and what you're trying to do is generate this, where you want to go with samatha is stable attention, powerful mindfulness. You want them to be effortlessly sustained. And then there should be the mental state of joy, which is really a reflection of how unified your mind is. The more and more your mind is getting behind this activity, rather than just, I'll let that part of my mind do this loving kindness thing if it wants. You know, so that you start to, and then the tranquility and the equanimity as the samatha matures. I would think doing loving kindness meditation, it would be very easy to, even before you had effortlessly stable attention and mindfulness, it would probably be very easy to enter into a kind of pleasure jhana, but it would be that pleasure that comes from loving kindness, you know, and the ingredients of loving kindness. Sounds like a very worthwhile thing to work on. I might have to look into that myself, but please do. You look into it and let us all know how it goes. Yeah, as I talk about it, I think, boy, that sounds like it could be a really fabulous practice.
I think it does work really well. I practiced something like that only like 4 months after I started meditating, and it seemed like I was able to get very light pleasure jhana-like experiences. Mm-hmm. My skills were pretty poor compared to how they are now back then, so there's a lot of dullness, I expect. But you can definitely get jhana states like way easier than anything else I've tried with it.
Okay, I think this is an avenue that we have to pursue. I will if I get around to it, but in the meantime, you know. Thank you.
I have a question about another type of meditation.
Yeah.
While we're talking about other types of meditation. There's a type of meditation that Shinzen Young calls do-nothing practice. I don't know if you're familiar with this instruction at all. It's something that I practiced a little bit.
Yeah.
Where the basic instruction is something like, yeah, let things come and go as they will, and whenever you notice an intention to manipulate your attention at all, let it go, if you can, if it feels voluntary.
Okay, so...
I find myself confused by certain aspects of this, and I wanted to ask.
I've heard from other people that Shinzen started talking about this, and I haven't had a lot of contact with Shinzen in the last few years. We see each other maybe once a year, and this is since I was paying closer attention to what he was doing. So I'll start off by saying I don't really know. I've heard this spoken of as do nothing meditation.
Yeah.
Now, based on your description of it right now, it sounds like a kind of what I call choiceless attention meditation, what some other teachers call choiceless awareness, but they don't use the term awareness in a specific way that I do. Yeah. But it sounds very similar to that.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that he describes this as something that you can practice sort of right from the beginning, and that it will... Yeah, you can progress from a very low skill level to a very high skill level and just doing this if you chose to, and maybe that wouldn't be optimal. But I find that I don't really understand how that would work and why it would not, for instance, just lead to lots of non-intending, non-perceiving moments, and how you would avoid dullness if you were practicing something like that.
That was, before you even said that, my reaction to the description that somebody... who didn't already have quite stable attention, I would picture them just tripping off in extended periods of mind wandering and sinking into a lot of dullness, and maybe a combination of both, bouncing back and forth between them. So it's interesting that he would suggest it for somebody that didn't have a lot of experience.
I think he suggests going back and forth between a number of practices depending on your state, but the idea that you could start with that and develop from there is interesting, because I don't really understand the principle, and it could be that there are just important pieces missing from the instruction.
You're going on limited information, and I'm going on almost no information at all. I don't want to say too much.
Gotcha.
It's worth mentioning that Shinzen equates that, or loosely equates it to Mahamudra and Dzogchen practice. So when I read those instructions and your instructions, the parallel that I drew was not to choiceless attention, although I see that, but to your instruction in the meditation on mind itself about not contracting or zooming in on objects with your attention.
Letting go of the object as soon as...
I don't know,
descriptions is really hard to comment.
Yeah.
You want to let Andrea...
Hi. So I read the stage 4 chapter after I talked to you this morning, and it referred to a practice in stage 3 about connecting, and that this was a really good tool for creating introspective awareness.
Right.
And I haven't got that chapter yet, and I'm wondering. Yeah. If you could maybe walk us through that, or if not walk us through it, but at least describe it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. The practice of connecting, the practice of following is identifying the beginning, the middle, and the end of each breath, and the pauses between the in and out breath, and then moving on beyond that to between the beginning and the end of the in breath and the out breath. Identifying as many consistently repeating sensations that happen with every in-breath and out-breath as you can. So the extension of that that's connecting is, first of all, it's noticing the different parts of the breath cycle relative to each other. You know, is the in-breath longer or shorter than the out-breath? Is the pause between the in and the out-breath longer than the pause between the out and the in-breath? Okay, so that's the beginning of connecting. Then you start to compare one breath to the next. Okay, so is the in-breath of this breath longer or shorter than the last one? Or are they the same? Is the out-breath longer or shorter or similar? Likewise, the pauses. And as soon as you start doing this, you'll notice that there might be 2, 3, 4 breaths that are very similar, but then the next one's going to be really different. The inhale is going to be longer or noticeably shorter, and all the other parts of the breath cycle will be different. The other thing is, over time, you'll see not just every so many breaths, there's one that's noticeably different, but you'll see, but that's connecting to notice that. And then further connecting is to notice that over time, that the whole description of a typical breath has shifted from what it was before. So maybe when you started out, that you'll have noticed that the out-breath was slightly longer than the in-breath, that the pause between the in and out-breath was pretty short, it was kind of a long pause after the out-breath before the next in-breath. Then you notice that later on, you know, you've been meditating for a while and your mind starts to get really calm, and you notice that it's different. That now the in-breath actually might be longer than the out-breath. And not only that, the pause between the out-breath and the in-breath might be very brief. And it's sort of like you're just taking in a small amount of air, and but you take it in, and there's this long, long pause before it relaxes and pushes the air out again. So So that's, as you see, there's connecting within a breath cycle, there's connecting from one breath cycle to the next, and there's connecting over larger periods of time. Then the other, what we're referring to there is that there is the other kind of connecting is to notice that when your breath falls into these different patterns, what mental states does that correspond to? When your mind is more agitated and restless and there's a lot of distractions, you'll have one pattern of the breath cycle. When your mind is calmer, there's a different pattern. When you're feeling a bit of dullness, there's yet another different pattern. So you can do connecting in terms of noticing the correlation between mental states and the breath cycle. So in stage four, in order to help you stay focused and allow your peripheral awareness to be watchful for gross distraction and strong dullness, you're using connecting to engage with the breath. And you can also start, you might especially notice this when you're working with dullness, when you get into one of those periods where the dullness keeps coming back. And you'll notice that your breath cycle has a particular pattern that's associated with that dullness. And this then can help you to recognize it. So that's connecting.
If you did notice that, could you then try to change your breath?
You could do is not to change your breath, because it might be helpful to change your breath. And you might, in fact, take a few deep breaths. But the main thing you want to do is not to try to change your mental state by changing your breath. Although I'll tell you that works very well. But that's not really what you want to do. Okay. What you want to do, if you can see an association with your breath and increasing agitation, or if you can see an association between a different breath pattern and increasing dullness, then you just use those to recognize those states early on and try to take some sort of corrective action. So at stage four, you might find that you're so intent on working hard and catching these distractions before they become gross distractions and your mind's starting to get agitated. And then you can say, okay, time to relax. My breath tells me I'm getting agitated, even though I may not be, may not be enough that I'm starting to be bothered by it. My breath's told me more quickly, and so let me just relax. Let me just take it easy. It's not going to be that bad if I have some gross distraction and have to correct for it, because that's what this stage is about. So that's the way that you would use it. Although it's a very interesting thing, and psychologists discovered this about the breath. I think I'm not sure. I became aware of it teaching physiology in the 70s and 80s. It was probably the 40s and 50s, but they noticed that there's very distinctive breath patterns associated with emotional states. And not only that, if you breathe in those particular patterns, you will generate the emotional state. So if you breathe the way an angry person breathes, you will start to feel angry. And it's a wonderful, and it's an amazing thing. It's sort of forceful exhales, and you start breathing like that, and you can just, So there's this very strong correlation between breath patterns and emotional state. And I think, whether consciously or unconsciously, I think people have been using that for a long time. I think that's one of those body language things that we may not consciously recognize that it's happening, but we often have a strong sense of somebody else's emotional state, and that's how we do it, is because we notice the respiratory changes. Like I say, I'm not recommending that you start manipulating your breath in meditation. But on the other hand, it would probably work if you did.
does this? So the connecting, using connecting to build up kind of a perception of a whole breath cycle as something that's qualities and can change, is that what eventually leads to developing the mental counterpart image of the breath?
It's,
so you're using connecting to perceive the whole breath cycle kind of as a unit. Or is that a separate thing?
Not really, although it is... In order to succeed at connecting, your mind's actually making use of the underlying phenomena that is the counterpart. Because it's much more efficient, you're following the breath, it's much more efficient for your mind to hold a sort of standing image of the average cycle. And so rather than following every element of the cycle, it just looks for, it just basically compares to see what's different. And so when you're following and you have the experience, that's described in several of the sutras, you know. When he breathes in a long breath, he knows he breathes in a long breath. When he breathes out a long breath, he knows he leaves it. He breathes out a long breath. But the way your mind's actually doing that, and it's happening at a subconscious level or unconscious level, it's comparing every breath to a standard. So what appears in consciousness is, oh, this is a long breath. Oh, this is a short breath. So it is actually the same phenomenon underlying. But it's a long trip from there to actually having that mental counterpart image show up in consciousness and to see it consciously. Might have lost some people on that who have not read and are not familiar with. As a matter of fact, mental counterpart images are not even in the more recently edited edition of that book. We took out that jhana and we took out those. So. It's down from 8 volumes to 6.
So that's going to go in the sequel?
I guess so, yeah. Or, you know, where it would go most appropriately would be maybe a separate book just on jhanas.
I've not read yet any of the stuff about jhanas, and if this doesn't seem like time to end, I read in like meditation online forums, people are like, oh yeah, I was meditating for 2 weeks and jhana this, jhana that, and da da da, and I've never been anywhere near a jhana, and you know, for me goes into my sort of doubt narrative, because I've been meditating forever and I don't know a jhana from a hole in the ground, but
it doesn't sound like something that people would be experiencing after 2 weeks, right?
Well, no, maybe they have different dispositions or aptitudes or whatever. I know there are some people who are kind of naturals at jhana.
You know what the main difference is what you define a jhana as. You can define a jhana in a way that somebody would say, oh yeah, I've been doing that since I was 4 years old. But you can also define jhana in such a way that the only way to achieve that jhana would be through many, many years of dedicated practice, and only a few individuals would have what it takes to actually achieve it. The biggest difference is when you hear that, is not to say, oh, I don't think that's really jhana. Just remember, it's all in the definition. But anyway, I think you were going to say something else, and I want to hear that.
I think a lot of this I should just read from your book, because my only explanation of jhanas is the form realm and the formless realm.
Yeah.
Are those, and that you know, I was taught that you really only need the first level of the form realm because that's where you perceive emptiness directly. But, you know, you've got whole sections on jhanas, and considering writing a book on jhanas, I assume there's a lot more juice in there than just that.
Yeah. There's much that we could say about it. But probably I can say with a pretty high level of confidence that the kinds of jhanas that were being discussed in the previous teachings that you've had were a pretty deep jhana, you know, that would not be particularly easily accessed. And the fact that you only need the form realm jhanas rather than formless jhanas and things like this. Technically, the formless jhanas are actually just variations on the fourth jhana. It's true. But what I've discovered is that there are other ways. I don't even think of it as other ways of defining jhana so much anymore, as there is a definition of jhana that has tremendous utility that is broad enough to encompass a lot of very light states of absorption as well as deep states of absorption. Now, of course, there are definitions of jhana that don't really involve a level of absorption that is of any value or significance at all. And I think that goes too far. But I found it extremely valuable to broaden the definition of jhana so that it includes lighter states of absorption. But you still need, in order for it to go from being less useful to more useful to being totally useless, is it has to be a definition that applies to something that has some real practical utility and has a commonality that extends across a whole range. And so as more and more people become familiar with the term jhana and start using it more, you're going to encounter more frequently references to jhana that are things that you might seriously question if there's much utility in them. If they're, you know, a definition of jhana where you have somebody stick their hand up and say, "I've been doing that since I was 4 years old," chances are it's going to be something that's going to be terribly useful. It may be interesting, but not terribly useful. The definitions that I use are based on a phenomenon that occurs outside of meditation that's called flow. You might have heard about flow states, a little bit. Csikszentmihalyi I find this extremely valuable, and you can recognize that jhanas are a category of flow states. And flow states have a certain uniqueness to them. And to be called a jhana, I'd say, first of all, it has to be a flow state. It has to be an absorption that meets a certain list of criteria. And then if it meets those, it's a flow state. Then, to be called a jhana, it has to be a flow state that occurs in meditation and that has a few additional criteria that it meets. And that I found to be a very useful definition that encompasses a broad range of states of absorption that are very valuable.
Just one last question about that is, at the state where I'm at, you know, I didn't pick up that chapter today because it seems like a little not very practical to where I'm at now.
Probably true.
It seems like the best reason for me to learn about it, maybe not even during this retreat, would just be to help with motivation or larger goals or that kind of thing.
it might. If you're going to read anything at all about jhanas in this retreat, I would say just read what it says about them in the chapter about using a whole body jhana in stage six. And you may very well have an opportunity to practice that jhana in this retreat, you know, and I hope you do. But if you find yourself, you know, you can have periods of stage six level of meditation after several days of retreat, even though when you go back out into the world, you know, you're not going to come close to them anymore. You can have them in the retreat. And if you do, and if you wish to try practicing the whole body jhanas, it can be extremely beneficial and it can accelerate your practice. So I would say feel free to have a look at the section on jhana in stage six. But don't worry about anything past that. It's just going to create mental agitation that won't bear any fruit in the next 5 or 6 days. I think that you're going to need to put the cooler on. The sun is shining on this roof. And that same moisture that was keeping us cool when it wasn't shining on the roof is turning this into a low-temperature sauna. So, would you like the microphone, or would you like to turn on the cooler? Yeah. I'll see if this is behaving. There it is. It got over whatever was bothering it.
Talk a little bit about Chinsent and Mihaly's. I don't think some people here know what that is. No?
I would encourage somebody to read the section in stage six about it. You know where I would go with a lot of our discussion today, and might be a good place to go tomorrow, is, you know, I made the statement early on about metacognitive introspective awareness, about ultimately that's what's really important about this whole thing. And that would be worth talking about. That in conjunction with why is it we're always concerned with the present, the present, the present, be totally present. What is this all about? So I'd say that's a direction that's worth talking about. I think maybe that's just the pump, isn't it? This present that we always talk about, I'm sure most of you at some time or another thought about what that is. What is the present? You start to look at it and it keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until it disappears. The present moment is this vanishingly small instant. It's not big enough to contain anything. So to be meaningful, it must be something different than that. But then if you start stretching its boundaries, how big does it have to be to still be the present? And what I think that has a lot to do with is a very important idea that developed very early in the history of Buddhism. It was formulated explicitly in
what's called the Abhidhamma, which wasn't really created until a couple of centuries after the Buddha passed. But it's all based on, it's based on a combination of things that the Buddha mentioned in passing or came up one way or another in the suttas, combined with the actual experiences of very powerful meditators. And it's the idea of the present reduced to a moment of consciousness. And that's a fascinating thing for us to look at, this moment of consciousness. You know, I think most everyone now, and probably most people in the time of the Buddha who were ever inclined to think about such things, quickly comes to perceive the universe as a duality of mind and matter, body and mind, and it is kind of a natural division, and everyone just kind of takes it for granted. There's this thing that goes on internally, this place where I live, where all of my experiences. And then there's this world outside. And even my body is really part of the world outside. And my mind is something that just seems to be so totally different. But it's connected to it all. And that's the idea of nama and rupa. Nama means name, and rupa means form. But by extension, nama means everything that is of the nature of mind, and rupa means everything that is the nature of matter. And there are some insights that everybody has as a result of meditating and practice. One of which is that you begin to realize that your experience can the totality of your experience can be divided into these two things, nama and rupa. And then, especially when you sit with your eyes closed and turn inward, you start to realize more and more that all you ever know are these two things, and that the rupa one is only in the form of sensation. So the contents of a moment of consciousness, therefore, are of two kinds. They're either mental objects generated by your mind, or they are sensations produced by the sense organs in your body. And this is the totality of your experience. It has been the totality of your experience since you came into being. And will be, is that sensations and mental constructs that are generated on the basis of those sensations. So this is called formally the insight into nama and rupa, and realizing that I am my experience of sensations and mental constructs in response to those sensations. And then to begin to explore the relationship between nama and rupa. So that would be a good place to continue from tomorrow. Discussion of nama and rupa and moments of consciousness and introspective awareness and the nature of reality. But one of the things that when you just think about what this insight into nama and rupa tells you is that the idea of your body and your sense organs is a mental construct in response to sensations that have arisen in your mind. All of a sudden, the idea that I have this body that's sensing the world around me, it starts to shift into a very different kind of thing. I just infer that I have a body. As a matter of fact, my body is a story that I have made up to account for my sensations. And the whole world is a story that I've made up to account for my sensations. So, that's a good place to leave things.